It's Monday, October 29, 2012. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. For the first time in many months, the lead news story and the issue at the forefront of most minds is not the 2012 presidential campaign, but Hurricane Sandy. That's true especially here in the United States and especially on the East Coast, where the outer effects of the 800-mile-wide storm, a Category 1 hurricane, are already being felt on the American East Coast and well into the eastern portion of the United States. As the storm is approaching the Northeast, it is now clear that evacuations have been called for. As is reported at CNN and at CBS, big cities from Washington to Boston buttoned up Sunday against the onslaught of a superstorm that could menace, they say, some 50 million people in the most heavily populated corridor in the nation. We're talking about a corridor that stretches from northern Virginia all the way up to north of Boston. We're talking about millions of people, well over 50 million people. And we're talking about the storm right now expected to go into one of the most vulnerable portions of this entire region, which is the area of northern New Jersey and the area with New York City itself right at the center. We're talking about a storm that has already killed 40 people in the Caribbean. Now, when you see fatality figures like that, you sometimes wonder, how is it that these figures are ascertained? It's not that necessarily these people were killed directly by the storm, but rather that their deaths would not have happened, at least in terms of any predictability, had the storm not occurred. So they will include persons, for instance, killed trying to build a dike to avoid the damage from the storm. Now, when you look at the northeastern United States and you look at 50 million people and you look at the storm barreling in with 75-mile-an-hour winds expected to dump multiple inches, indeed potentially multiple feet of flooding, with a potential 11-foot storm wall headed into the coast, including the region of the most vulnerable area of New York City, then you're looking at a potential for a massive loss of life and furthermore, massive loss of property. Now, as preparations for the storm are being made, airlines in the United States have canceled more than 5,000 flights. It is not expected that any commercial air service will happen in the northeastern corridor on either Monday or Tuesday of this week, at the very least. Amtrak began suspending train service on Sunday because many of its tracks run along the most vulnerable area. They simply cannot afford to put people in harm's way, nor to allow their trains to become stranded. All over the Northeast, similar decisions are being made. The mayor of New York City has already announced the closing down of New York City public transit. That effective tomorrow morning. Public schools in New York City have already been canceled. The FEMA, that is the Federal Emergency Management Authority, is already putting out its advisories. As Craig Fugate, the director of FEMA, said, the time for preparing and talking is about over. And of course it is, as the storm is now headed in. That's what makes a story published in USA Today early this morning of particular concern. It tells us a great deal about human nature. It turns out that because last year Hurricane Irene came with a great deal of warning but didn't pack such a punch, a significant number of people up in the Northeast are saying that they're going to ride this one out. There are so many dimensions of human nature that come out in a context such as this. Extremity in the weather sometimes pulls out extremity in human behavior. You have such examples as what is now happening among politicians and political leaders. They have learned from previous mistakes, from the failure to take such warnings seriously, the failure to urge people by every available means to take the requisite precautions. You also have, of course, on the other side, people who look at this and think they can simply write it out, or they base their expectation on previous experience rather than on the warnings. We've talked about the fact that we human beings are so very small. We can do nothing over against these storms, nothing to mitigate their power, but there are things we can do in order to mitigate their effects. This puts us in a categorically different position than most human beings who lived before us in virtually all centuries. We do have tracking mechanisms whereby we can watch these storms. We do have skilled forecasters who can predict the course of the storms. And we do have technology and experience to tell us how we can at least lessen the risk and increase the chances of the survival of people who are in the harm's way. By the way, one of the most frustrating and dangerous dimensions of this storm is that it is likely to move so slowly. It is a Category 1 storm. It's now expected to hit the coast in its Category 1 force. That's approximately 75 miles per hour sustained winds. That's a very high rate of wind. But the problem is it's going to stay in place, and it's expected to dump as many as 7 to 14 inches of water an hour. You're talking about an absolute disaster in terms of the potential for flooding. And so what we're going to be watching here is a significant portion of the United States at a very clear and present risk as this day unfolds and as tomorrow dawns. So as Christians looking at this, we know there's very little we can do. There is nothing we can do to hold up something to stop the winds of this storm. There's virtually nothing we can do on the scale of humanity to hold back the tidal surge. But we can take responsibility to, first of all, do everything we can to help our neighbor where there is such an opportunity, and where there is not, to pray for those who are in harm's way. At the end of the day, for most of us across the United States, that's right now the most important thing that we can do. We'll be tracking the storm with you, and meanwhile, so are the candidates. The presidential candidates, President Obama and Mitt Romney, have both been trying to do their best in the days leading up to the advent of this storm to reach people who are likely to be in the affected areas. The shutdown of transportation is likely to create a huge mess for the plans for whatever rallies and appearances the presidential candidates could have in the eastern portion of the country. But once again, they're running for the office of President of the United States. Even as President of the United States, much less as a candidate for the office, there's virtually nothing they can do about the weather. There will undoubtedly be plenty to talk about in terms of that campaign this week, but the other big issue this week is the celebration of Halloween. Halloween has now become the second largest holiday in America in terms of consumer spending. That is an incredible statistic, and it's also a very recent statistic. Up until very recently, Halloween had been a suburban activity for small children, but it is now an adult holiday, the second largest adult holiday in terms of consumer spending. Bruce Horowitz, writing in last week's edition of USA Today on Thursday, talks about a Wednesday night that is a Halloween night party in New York City's Greenwich Village that's expected to pull in 2 million people, 90% of them grown-ups. He writes the annual event, now in its 39th year, is the Greenwich Village Halloween Parade, which will go on all night, filling bars, restaurants, hotels, and acting as a $90 million instant stimulus to New York City's economy. He then goes on and writes, "This adultification of Halloween is taking place in virtually every city. At bars, at restaurants, at theaters, even at high-end gift shops. Like treats snatched from a trick-or-treat bag, adults have slowly been stealing Halloween from kids for years. Now it appears grown-ups own the holiday. How do they own it? $8 billion to be spent this year. Approximately $1.2 billion on adult costumes. Only $1 billion or less on children's costumes." The National Retail Federation tells us that just 7 years ago, when adults were asked if they planned to celebrate Halloween, only 52.5% said yes. Remember, that's just 7 years ago. Now, 71.5% said yes. "I call it occupying Halloween," said consumer anthropologist Robbie Blinkoff. "My gut tells me that it's bigger than Halloween and it's actually part of our culture. We need to creatively express ourselves to find pure joy," end quote. I read that quotation just so you could hear it in full force. Here's a man who thinks the Halloween can deliver, quote, pure joy. Horowitz goes on to write, "A decade ago, fewer than 3 in 10 costumes purchased at HalloweenInExpress.com were for adults. Now it's more than 6 in 10. By the way, the average American adult is going to spend $123 this Halloween. That's more than twice the average, $53, that was spent a year ago." That's right, a year ago. So you're talking about 1 year, the increase in spending from an average of $53 to $123. This is, as Horowitz says, an adult takeover of Halloween, now emerging as the number two holiday in consumer spending right after Christmas. Maybe, he says, it's because Halloween is about friends, not family, or perhaps it's because there are really no gifts to purchase, no religious rituals to observe, and rarely any red-eye plane trips that are involved. Gene Fleming, who is the organizer of the Greenwich Village Parade, says this, "Halloween has become an adult holiday for the new American family. You stay right where you are and you celebrate with your friends," end quote. Well, it's not likely that Greenwich Village is the perhaps most important barometer of the normal American family, especially when it comes to this Halloween parade. But the adultification of Halloween is not limited to Greenwich Village, as these statistics have made clear. Leanne Bannatyne, who's written a book on Halloween, in fact, it is entitled Halloween Nation, Behind the Scenes of America's Fright Night, writes that it was a child-focused holiday, especially in the 1950s and beyond. But as suburban tracts grew, kids carrying pillowcases littered with candy became a familiar sight. Quote, "But you knew Halloween was changing when Hugh Hefner started throwing the big Halloween parties at the Playboy Mansion." You look at this and you realize this tells us something about America and something about our contemporary culture. At albertmoeller.com, I've reposted an article that I wrote just a few years ago entitled Christianity and the Dark Side, What About Halloween? Most American Christians are just unfamiliar with the sources of the holiday, very important pagan Halloween sources. But beyond all that, there is simply no question that as Halloween has become a very current and commercial holiday, it represents a cultural fascination with evil and the demonic. Even as the society has pressed the limits on issues such as sexuality, the culture's confrontation with the dark side has also pushed beyond boundaries that had been honored in the past. Now, for that reason, I also want to bring to your attention several articles current in the press about the sexualization of girls, very young girls, when it comes to Halloween costumes. Deborah Tolman, writing at the Huffington Post, writes, "In a perverse appropriation of girl power, many versions of sexy women will be winding their way through the streets of America this Halloween. They'll have bought their French-maid outfits, pink pussycat heels, and midriff-bearing bad girl university sweaters online or at a big-box store near you." End quote. It's true. Even some of the commercial Halloween costumes for tweens and young girls are highly sexualized. Tolman goes on to write, "That Halloween has gone from scary to sexy in recent years is a reflection of a profound and problematic social issue. The sexualization of girls. Such portrayals of young girls are so familiar to us and to girls themselves that it seems normal, harmless, and simply the way that girls are nowadays. In fact, it passes as liberation," she writes. "Just look at all the power girls have now. The power to shop, to look cute, and to be sassy." The most concerning portion of Tolman's article has to do with where she addresses parents. She excuses parents for their failure to draw the line here, blaming a consumerized society for forcing parents to be more concerned about the well-being of their children. Listen to her words. She says this, "But for various reasons, we as parents have not said no to the retailers, because too often in this ever more consumer-driven society, we do not say no to our children. We're afraid of what can happen when our children don't conform or we resist too much, like the 6-year-old kicked off her cheerleading team in Michigan because her parents protested a sexualized cheer." She writes, "It's easy for moralizers to blame parents for saying yes and to blame girls for wanting and wearing. Placing the blame on individuals deflects attention from the rampant commercialization of childhood and the pornification of products marketers peddle to younger and younger children. Sure, we can say no. Many of us do. But we're up against corporations willing to invest billions to cultivate our child's desire for the right look and to heighten their anxiety about not matching up." End quote. That is one of the most cowardly double paragraphs I think I've ever read. Where you have someone blaming retailers, who after all deserve all the blame we can put on them for carrying such things, and marketers, who do deserve all the blame we can put on them for marketing such things, but at the end of the day, they can only sell and they can only market what someone is morally willing to buy. And that's the problem here. You have parents who are more concerned with their children's status among their peers, or for that matter, their ability to be on a cheerleading team for 6-year-olds, which also begs the imagination. And when it comes down to it, they simply are unwilling to say no. Well, when it comes to Halloween, as when it comes to virtually anything of importance, if parents can't say no, our children are just put into an ever more vulnerable situation. Christian parents thinking about Halloween have a lot to think about. I have resources provided at my website for people who would like to at least find some place to begin thinking through the issue of Halloween, but we do need to raise the question as to why we would allow our children, under any circumstances, to embrace the so-called dark side, the very thing that Christianity is to rescue us from, rather than to celebrate. What we have here, of course, is a situation in which the innocence of suburban trick-or-treating is something that most of us as parents remember. So long as it's that and just that, we don't have a major moral problem. But it's no longer just that. Not when the biggest dimension of the holiday is now for adults rather than for children, and when the biggest dynamic in terms of the adult participation is sex, even as much as being scared. USA Today wrote a very interesting cover story in its Thursday edition last week. Millions of Americans undoubtedly saw the cover story. But even greater numbers of millions of Americans are going to see the effects of Halloween on Wednesday night. And Christian parents and Christian young people are absolutely right to be thinking about that issue before the day comes. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.